Good morning. I'm Tom B., and I'm an alcoholic from Louisville, Kentucky. I'm at my first international conference in 28 years and 11 months sobriety, so... Yep. You always get to be a newbie, right? The two guys from Cleveland are here, so we can start this meeting. I told them I'd wait for them. My sponsor and my wife are in this room, so I'm under a lot of pressure right now. I wonder if we can start with a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 75 years. We have with us today, all right, it's here. Bear with me. Too much paper. Loretta B. from New York, TJ from Georgia, and Marsha from California. And we'll begin with Loretta.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Loretta, and I'm an alcoholic. And I find it sort of astounding I'm standing here. My anniversary will be July 19th, 1983. And if you told me even the first 5 years in AA that I was going to be an international convention of alcoholics, I would have said, you got to be kidding. Why would I go to a convention of alcoholics? This is my third. And each time it's changed, it hasn't gotten better, it's just gotten wonderful. Because as I change, everything around me changes, you know, or everything stays the same, but I change and I react to it differently. I was looking at the topic for the past 3 or 4 weeks thinking, you know, at the turning point. And I forgot it was in the big book till this morning that, you know, at the turning point we began to ask for help. So I've been trying to think because I heard so many wonderful speakers here and I'm not good at, they were taking notes and preparing, and I can't prepare for a qualification. I do a lot of public speaking in my work. I get paid to do that. I have to come here out of my heart because my head got me into trouble. I remember when I first came into the program and a friend said to me, you're so gosh darn smart. Maybe you should put your brain out of your head and just come here and listen. Because if you had cancer, wouldn't you learn about cancer? And maybe you're an alcoholic, because I didn't think I was. Come here and learn about alcoholism and see if you are one. Well, that was August 1983, and I've been coming ever since. And when I was drinking, I had a lot of turning points, and I was sharing earlier. I didn't know they were turning points. My life kept getting worse, and I didn't know it. I couldn't understand why I was going downhill. I was hanging on by my fingertips. I had a house in the Hamptons. I had a job that I loved. I had a big job, to be perfectly honest. At 30, I had a huge job. And in my mid-30s, I started going sideways and then backwards. I didn't lose my job. I had rules that would have made me the president of the United States about drinking. I didn't drink in the morning. Alcoholics did that. I didn't drink at business meetings. Alcoholics did that. I didn't drink with a hangover. Alcoholics did that. But you know what? The ism brought me to my knees. And the person who 12-stepped me, I'll never forget, but she was supposed to be here and couldn't come. She said she was a controlled drinker. I didn't know I was being 12-stepped. A young woman who worked for me, it was her sponsor. And I was so thrilled this young woman had stopped drinking. Imagine, I was thrilled she had stopped drinking. So I'm having dinner with her and her sponsor, never knowing anything about AA, and thinking, what is this cult thing they have going? And she said, she was a controlled drinker. She was a very well-known actress in New York. So I was impressed she was a well-known actress, not that she was an AA. And she said she was a controlled drinker. And I said, how can you be an alcoholic? I mean, how can you be an alcoholic if you're a controlled drinker? And she said, Loretta, only alcoholics have to control their drinking. And I felt like that was a turning point. I didn't say anything to her. I felt, and I was drinking that night, I felt as if I'd been kicked in the stomach. I don't know what she said after that. I have no idea. We talked for an hour more. All I can remember thinking, oh, my God. Because I had never heard the term controlled drinker. And I had one more night out, shall we say, and it broke every one of my rules. It was a dinner in honor of me. My career was back on track. I don't remember getting home. And publishing it was for an author. She went to Hazleton 6 months later, so you can imagine what the dinner was like. And I got up the next day and didn't go to work. And my mantra was, don't drink if you can't get to work. Not don't drink. Don't drink if you can't get to work. And I couldn't get to work. I was humiliated. And I had to go meet someone for lunch who I couldn't find. I had to go. I shook through the whole lunch. And I went home that afternoon. It was a day like this. And at that point, I lived on Park Avenue. And I stopped to get ice cream because I didn't know that, but I used sugar to recover from my hangovers. And I almost passed out. I cry every time I think about this. I had a pint of Häagen-Dazs in my hands. And I'm on Park Avenue, and I'm scared I'm going to pass out. And what will happen? And I didn't even understand hangovers. You know, I was in with terrible withdrawal. And I got home to my apartment, and I called this young woman who worked for me and asked for help. I had no intention of going to AA. I just didn't know what to do. And I went out to the country the next day, and my older brother was there, who had stopped drinking 2 days before or something. And I called her every day, and I didn't drink. And I still count that as my anniversary because I was talking to someone in the program. And I haven't had a drink a day at a time since then. And 3 weeks later, I met my older brother, who I love dearly, and he had 4 double scotches. And I thought, he's going to die. And I went to my first meeting for him. And we all know I was going for me. You know, that was what got me there. He's sober today. My sister's sober today. My mother got sober at 76 and died with 19 years. So it is a program of attraction. My younger brother doesn't have the disease. I'm one of 29 cousins. 23 of us got sober all over the country. 4 or 5 died, and 1 is in a coma right now from this disease. It's just tragic. He overdosed on antidepressants, and they're going to have to pull the plug. And I know he was suffering from depression. He's a paraplegic from Vietnam. What a way to die. He was sober for a couple of years and just couldn't do it. So this disease kills you one way or another. You know, I'm waiting for the phone call. So in my drinking, the moments came and went with things getting worse. But there were turning points when I made that phone call, when I went out and bought honey and lemon for tea, when I went to my first meeting for my brother. And what happened to me over the years is I began to see turning points again and again and again. You know, I remember standing on 3rd Avenue when I was about 18 months sober, and I was beside myself. I didn't know how I was going to do this. I had drink signals 20 times a day for the first 5 years. I thought you people who said your signals were lifted were liars. I just didn't understand it. My sponsor gave me wonderful advice and said, you know, every time you get a drink signal and your life has gotten so much better, that's a reminder you're an alcoholic. And I used it that way, and it was. I needed to be reminded again and again that I had a drinking problem because I wanted to pretend I didn't. The signals, you know, I'd be going to a fabulous party. Everything would be wonderful, and all I could think of was I can't drink at the party. And I'd be 2 or 3 years sober. But I always came with someone from the program. I always had a phone number. And somehow or other, I didn't drink because I always had a support system. But I remember standing on 3rd Avenue thinking, I can't make all these decisions. I can't do this. And for some reason, the third step came into my head. And I thought, I don't have to. I don't have to make any decisions today. I just don't have to drink. And it was like, phew. And that's when I understood the third step. That was at 18 months. I was 5 or 6 years sober, and I wanted to open my own business. And I was terrified. Absolutely terrified. And I was at a meditation meeting, which I still go to out in the country, and we meditate for 20 minutes, and I was crying, and I don't cry easily. My family didn't cry. You know, we took care of business. We didn't cry. And a woman came over to me and gave me such a present, and she said, after the meeting was over, she said, do you think if you fell backwards, God would catch you? And I often share this, and I almost hit her. I said, what do you, for 3 seconds. And then I realized, yes, I did. I really, honestly, I didn't know I believed God would catch me. You know, so these turning points, for me, have happened so gradually, you know, meeting after meeting, year after year, that someone else, another alcoholic, has always told me when it happened, helped me find out that it happened. And every time I see her, I give her a hug. Because I said the only problem is I'm always caught 3 inches from the floor, and it makes me very nervous. I'm going backward, and I'm never quite sure when I'm going to be caught. But I honestly, I do believe I'm going to get caught. And so the turning points are so many. And in my daily life, as a recovering person, and I go to meetings all the time, and so many of my friends have come into the rooms, or they were in the rooms when I got here. I knew them out of the rooms. My whole family is sober. But one of the reasons I like coming to a meeting, and I also like doing going back to certain places where I drank, is the longer I'm sober, the busier my life is, the richer my life is. There's so many things in my life that are beyond my wildest dreams. And I don't mean money. Not that I don't want money, but I don't mean money. We all know what I mean. There's a richness to my life. There's a peace to my life. But I don't always get a chance to reflect on my life. So when I get out of my routine and coming here, I've had the chance to do a lot of reflection. I was in San Antonio 30 or 35 years ago, and I was drinking, and a relationship that should have happened didn't happen because of it, and I haven't been back since. And I'm looking at a lot of memories, a lot of painful memories. And I'm making peace with a lot of memories. And I was talking to a man in New York, and he said, maybe you're going to San Antonio to make an amends. And I wasn't looking at it that way. And you know, he's right. He was right. It really stopped me dead in my tracks. He has no idea what he said to me. But it is a turning point, and I have to say I am so grateful for the tools I've learned in here to look at my life and not beat myself up. I've learned to forgive myself. I've learned to understand. I remember my first or second year, a wonderful woman saying to me, you know, Loretta, your alcoholism is a disease. Your sobriety is your responsibility. Take care of it. And so when I look at my past, I had a terrible disease. I hate alcoholism. I hate it. I've seen it wreck more people's lives. It wrecked a lot of, it deprived me of so much for so many years. Even though on the outside I had a lot of things. I went to a lot of fabulous places. I had a huge fancy dinner party given to me in London, and I sat there with a knife in my hand so I wouldn't fall asleep because I was so hungover from the night before. With a fork. I thought, I've got to get out of this dinner and get back to the hotel. The joy, you know, I mean, it was just, and I thought that was normal. And as I say, I didn't drink 2 days in a row, but alcoholics said that, so I suffered through the dinner and went home, and the next day I drank and took care of it. Believe me. But in the program, through the steps, I've had incredible turning points again and again and again. And we all know what Mrs. Ford has given us all, and I worked with her on a project. And I remember in her book saying, one of the wonderful parts about being in recovery is that we can always look back the year before and see changes. And those are turning points. I've been doing a lot of thinking since I've been here about what I couldn't do last year. I went to the airport. I didn't think I was going to get here. There was a hurricane. And I was perfectly fine. I bought a book, and I thought, and I got here early. You know, don't ask me why, but the planes were early. But if you had told me 10 years ago that I could go to the airport when a hurricane and I might not make it and be perfectly fine about it and go back to my apartment, I would have said, you're crazy. So there's been so many things that have changed in me from the year before, the year before, the year before. And it's all because of you. Because when I come to meetings, I hear how I've changed. I hear my turning points. You know, in my first year or two, this guy got up. Oh, he was Mr. Wall Street. I thought, oh, spare me. What do I have in common with this guy? I want to listen to him. You know, and I don't like Wall Street even today, but then I hated it. So, and forgive me if anybody's on Wall Street. And he got up, and he told me, in his qualification, he said he didn't open his mail. I had never told anybody I didn't open my mail. And I didn't open my mail because I was scared. Mind you, I ran a division in a company. It's pretty bad when you don't open your mail. And I was worried there would be bad news. I mean, I selected the letters I didn't want to look at on a Friday. And then I worried all weekend. And then sometimes opened up the letter on Monday and it had good news. What a way to live. the torture I put myself through. So it was qualifications from other alcoholics that taught me how I had changed and how I've had endless turning points in my life. And you know what? My mother died at 95 with 19 years. And when I went into her apartment, she had, not this book, this is mine, she had a book that I gave her. And it was underlined, 365 days. And it wasn't underlined on every day. It was underlined maybe in 50 days with all the character defects, by the way, that I had that I was reading. But I thought, there she was, her mind was clear as bell, at 93 getting better. There she was working on herself. And a lot of the underlinings were about her children. You know, I let my children grow, let them, you know. And I treasure that book. I treasure it. And I had no idea. And as long as I come here, and I'll just send them that, as long as I don't drink, as long as I come to meetings, I love meetings. I come because I love meetings. In the beginning, I came because I had to. Now I can't imagine not coming to meetings. And as long as I come here, I can't not change. It's impossible. You all make it impossible for me not to again and again grow and change. So, you know, it began as dealing with the physical part of my disease, then the mental, and then the spiritual. And it's just a profound gift that we've all been given and that I've been given. And it is beyond my wildest dreams. So I thank you all for listening and for being here. And I wish you a wonderful rest of the convention.
Thank you, Loretta. And now we'll put the thorn between two roses. And here's TJ.
I appreciate that. My name is TJ. I'm a recovering alcoholic. On the way out here, I was on Delta flight, and I would love to know how much sobriety was on there. They didn't sell one drink on the airplane, I don't think. But I got sober in 1973 in a ridiculous place to get sober, in Germany. If you've had any German wine or German beer, it's probably the best that you can get. But I was always a normal drinker. I never was an alcoholic. I always was a normal drinker. And I'd white knuckle it or gut control it until I found somebody to drink like I drank. And I'd go to a club or I'd go to a bar and I'd watch people drink. And I'd white knuckle it for a while and I found who the heavy hitters were. And those are the people I drank with. So I was a normal drinker. My turning point was in 1973. My last drunk was sort of a weird drunk, I guess. I got angry at my wife, which I got angry at my wife quite often, because she would control me and I didn't want to be controlled, and she didn't want me to drink and I would drink and stuff like that. But my last drunk that I had wasn't a pretty drunk. I'm a blackout drinker. And when I drink, bad things happen. I've got a temper. I'm anesthetized. I don't feel any pain. And so if I don't feel any pain, I find the biggest guy in the bar and talk about his mother. And I don't say flowery stuff about it either. But that's what happens when I drink alcohol. So I drank for many years, and I started at age 15 drinking, I think. And I quit at age 33. In between that, there was a lot of blackouts, a lot of jails, that kind of stuff. But in 1973, my last drunk, I drank with this guy for a long time. This guy's name was Don. And Don quit drinking. And I didn't understand that. But I would ask him, let's go have a drink. He'd say, tomorrow. And I didn't want to wait till tomorrow. And I'd ask him the next day. He'd say, tomorrow. And so my last drunk, I woke up in the morning. My wife said, I'm going to leave you. And she meant it. And I think that was my turning point whenever she was going to leave me. And I called Don. I said, Don, I've got an alcohol problem. And he said, well, what is it? And I told him, I said, you know, I drink just like you drink. And he said, well, if you want to stop, said, I can take you to a place that'll help you stop. I said, what is that place? He said, it's just a club I belong to. And I said, okay, I want to go. And I went, and I walked in the room, and there was about six or eight people in the room. And the max sobriety was a year. And believe it or not, the guy who I guess was in charge of this thing, I guess chairman, chairperson, the director, whoever it was, he went out and got drunk, and he got his ear chipped, and went and got drunk. And so everybody he sponsored did that. And I didn't want him for a sponsor. So I picked me a secret sponsor. I got me a secret guy that he was my shining knight, even my armor guy. And I said, he's going to be my sponsor. Well, lo and behold, his wife Loretta called me one night, and she said, Dick is drunk. I said, what? Because I didn't know that. But that was my first 12-step call. He was my secret sponsor. And I put this guy on a pedestal, and it didn't work out. But I went did my first 12-step call, but I didn't do it by myself. I ain't too smart some of the time, but I'm smart enough that know that I need to care somebody who's got sobriety. So I had, I don't know, 4 or 5 months in the program, and I went and got somebody, and we went out and 12-step Dick. And the guy went out there and just talk nasty to him. Get up out of bed and that kind of good stuff. But anyway, he got sober, and I got sober. And I've had several turning points in my lifetime also. You know, I started working. I didn't know anything about steps when I came in. Now, I didn't care anything about steps when I came in. I wanted to find out how you didn't drink, and I wanted to find out what you did. And I finally got me a sponsor. And once I got a sponsor, I finally started doing what he told me to do. And I saw a lot of changes in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not sure I like them too much. The meetings I go to are hour meetings. And I'm not sure I like an hour meeting. I think I'm probably sicker than I probably need 2 hours sometimes. But, you know, it's sort of weird. The first 20 minutes, they read. Next 5 minutes, do an introduction. So that leaves you about 50 minutes to talk. But anyway, when I got sober in Hanau, Germany, and I got sober with about 6 or 8 people. And every group I've been to ever since then had about 6 or 8 people in it. I don't seem to have a big group. When I was in Tokyo, there was 3 people in our group in Tokyo. And for one of the big meetings, I had to go to Tokyo to a big meeting. And I was in Camp Zama, and we only had 3 people in Camp Zama. For one of the big meetings, I had to go to Tokyo. And there was only about 20 people in the meeting. But I married a drinking buddy. I met this little girl, and she drank liquor, and I drank liquor. And so I decided that if I'll get married, I'll straighten up and fly right. So I married this girl, met her in a bar. And so we got to court, and I married her, and we got married. And she drank for a long time. And, of course, when I got sober, she continued to drink. And when I first got sober, I'd come home, and there'd be a beer sitting on my nightstand, be a beer in the kitchen, be a beer in the bathroom. She wanted me to drink because I guess she wanted to control me. But once I got sober, things began to happen to me that I never, it's beyond my wildest dreams sometimes. The best it gets on any given day is when I cut my grass on my riding tractor. It don't get no better than that. Okay, I was riding in a golf cart this morning up in the main hall up here. It don't get no better than that. You know, and that, you know, what can I say except serenity and peace of mind, I guess, is what I look for in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've seen people come in AA. They don't do step 4 and step 5, and they're miserable. And when I did step 4 and step 5, a lot of the stuff that happened to me left. And thank God that it did. And you know, I hate saying anything good about alcohol, but I can tell you some good stuff about alcohol. I have 2 children in California. that have never touched a drop of alcohol because of me and my behavior. So I guess that's a good thing about alcohol is my kids have never messed with it because my behavior was so bad that didn't find anything to do with it. But that's some of the good things. And I'm not sure that alcohol wasn't good for me. Because I'm not sure I could live with me without an escape mechanism, a place to run to. I'm not sure I could stand pressures and emotional strain and that kind of stuff. And so when I drank alcohol, it gave me a relief valve. I could go into a bottle and go to a fantasy world. And once when I went to this fantasy world, it was a good place for me to be. Because I didn't have to deal with reality and have to deal with life. I had to deal with everyday problems. Today I don't have a drinking problem unless I drink alcohol. But I have a living problem. I have a problem with anger. I have a problem with resentment. And those things that will get me drunk if I rest on my laurels. Alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And when I look at that aspect of it, when I go up in my head and start to wander around in my head a little time, I can handle one. I always could handle one. But the thing about it is, I didn't have a problem stopping. I get some remorse, some guilt, and I would stop for a period of time. Till when the remorse was gone, the guilt was gone, I'd pick right back up again. So my problem was staying stopped. I could not stay stopped until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they told me, if you'll stop one day at a time, that's all you need to do is stop one day at a time. And I stopped one day at a time. And one day at a time, all of a sudden became a year. And so I was getting close to this year. And I started to figure out, well, how am I going to get past a year without taking a drink? Because this guy had drank in a year. And so I came up with all kind of means. I was going to chain myself to a radiator. I had going to get me a chain and radiator, enough chain to get to the bathroom. And I was going to take a month's leave out of the Army. And I got to chain myself to a radiator and help my wife bring my food and take all the beer out of the house and that kind of good stuff. So I figured, well, that's not going to work too well. So I said, I'll just skip a year. And so It came to my birthday, and I didn't say a word about it. And I waited till the next month, and I got past that year. And then I picked up my year's chip. But I had never thought I'd get past a year. And if you would tell me today that I'd be in a room like this, and my little home group now has 6 people in it. But we have 120 years sobriety. 26 people. And I call it sticking with the winners. And I stick with the winners. Now, I'll tell you something. Young people are important in Alcoholics Anonymous because they're going to carry the flag and the torch for AA. But if I got a problem, I want to call an old timer. I want to call somebody who got some life experiences. I want to call somebody who can say, all right, this is what I did and this is how I did it. And you know what? My sponsor got all the answers. And if he ain't got the answers, his sponsor does. But I'm a believer in sponsorship, and I'm a believer in working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am not too keen on traditions, though. And I'll tell you why. Because the newcomer don't know a thing about traditions. They're important to AA, but they're not important to the newcomer. And I'm all about the newcomer. I'm all about caring for the next alcoholic who still suffers. But like I said, I've been all within small groups. And when we had somebody come in, if you had an overeating problem, come in and tell us about it. I want to hear about your addiction. Because 3 people, them drunk a lot, get really old after about a year, 3 people. So, you know, if you're a drug addict and there's not an NA meeting, come on in. You know, I've never been one to be saying, who am I to judge you, judge, jerk, and executioner? You know, and I saw a lot of old-timers. We had a guy come in one time dipping snuff. And that's a nasty habit. And this guy was spitting in a cup. Well, one old-timer said, that's nasty. You ought not to do that in here. I got him left. I run him down. I said, get back in that meeting. And I had left a meeting one time like that. We had a young lady come in, good-looking young lady, and everybody flocked to her. Well, we had this old guy come in, couldn't read and write. Nobody said anything to him. And I threw my daughter down on that desk and walked out of that meeting, never going back. A bunch of hypocrites. And my sponsor called me. He said, boy, what you doing? I told him. I said, them hypocrites over there, I said, you see what they did? He said, you won't change me? I said, yeah. He said, if you ain't there, it won't be made. You know, so go to meetings. You know, AA, to me, 10% do all the work, 90% reap all the benefits. And I've always been one for service work. And my every sponsor I've had and everybody I sponsor goes into service work. Yeah, that's where it's at. If it wasn't service work, this convention wouldn't have took place. Okay? And so anytime, you know, I started up like everybody else, I guess, cleaning ashtrays, because then you could smoke an A back in them days. And I cleaned ashtrays, and then I got promoted to making coffee. And after I made coffee, while they fired me. And I got a resentment. Because I made the best coffee ever made in Alcoholics Anonymous. But they fired me. And said, well, now they're going to count money. I thought they made me the treasure. I said, you know what you're doing? I said, I ain't being one to be trusted with money. But they trusted me with the money. And I remember very diligently I'd count them in account in front of somebody. And I'd initial my little envelope. They'd initial my little envelope. But, and then I went on from that to, I finally got where I could chair a meeting. And I remember I came in, I changed the chairs around. I changed, they were in a circle, and I didn't want them in a circle. I wanted them in a straight line. And I changed them chairs around, and they had a group conscience. And I couldn't believe what they told me to do. They told me, you better change them chairs back. And I wouldn't think people get so upset over chairs. But they did. But I changed the chairs back. I never changed them after that. Anytime I do anything today, I go to the group and say, can I do this? They say, yeah, you can do it. Then I go do it. But if they say no, I just back off and let it go on about the business. You know, and money. Don't spend a dollar of A's money. You get in trouble over money. But, you know, I'm glad I'm here, because if I wouldn't be here, I don't think I'd be anywhere. Because I did everything except die. And, when I look at the amount of alcohol I consume sometimes, I'm lucky I didn't die. And I'm lucky I didn't die. And look at some of the places I went to and some of the things I did, talking about people's mamas. That'll get you put in the hospital quick. But I do know that being sober has opened a world that I ever knew existed. And it was sort of weird that when I came in AA, I hated me with a passion. I was self-destructive. And I remember people saying, let me love you until you can love yourself. And I think that's one of the reasons today that I keep coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous, is people love me. And I also come back to remind myself where I can go to if I'm not real careful. I'm one drink away from a drunk. And I don't take a drink, I take a drunk. If I could take a drink, I would. But I can't take a drink. I didn't know that until I started looking back. I didn't know alcohol was the root of all my problems until I've been sober for a while and looked back at my drinking record. I took an honest inventory of what alcohol had done to me and when it had done it. And I can go back to, there's a lot of reasons I drank alcohol, I guess. And I guess self-esteem is one of them. I had real low self-esteem. I guess one reason I drank. But I essentially drank because of the effect it produced. I like what it did to me. And, you know, I'm real grateful that I'm here standing today, because I look at people who have a desire to stay sober. We had a guy in Germany named Gimp Leg John. And Gimp Leg John had a hip injury in the Second World War. And one of his legs was shorter than the other one by about 5 inches. The bus ran to about a mile from where the meeting was. John would take the bus to the getting off point. At dead of winter, John would walk to a meeting. He had a desire to stay sober. Well, John was sort of weird. John wanted to buy a typewriter. It's all he thought. All he talked about was buying this typewriter. And every time he talked, we'd go just like that. But you know what? John was sober for 9 years, talking about his typewriter. I was sober for 9 years, listening to him talk about his typewriter. So it must have worked pretty well. We had a guy.
Am I done?
I'm close. We had a guy that had a teddy bear's higher power, but it worked for him. Whatever you have for higher power, it works for you. Thank you. Let me share.
Thanks, TJ. And now, Marsha from California.
Marcia, I'm an alcoholic. I want to say, gosh, I'm really glad to be here. I think I'll even be gladder when 20 minutes is up. You know, the thing that amazes me whenever I come to a convention or a big meeting is that we all have a story. I mean, everybody here's got a story. And I'm sure your story was horrible. You know, when you were out there, I'm sure it was horrible. I thought mine was the most horrible for a long time. But I've heard a lot of people share. And, you know, mine's just one of many. It's just another story. But the turning point for me came in October of 1973. I had been using drugs and alcohol for about 10 years. And when I first started, you know, I thought I was pretty smart. I thought I really had it all together. I actually thought I was smarter than most and had big plans for my future. And 10 years later, I wound up in a Skid Row motel. My brother was paying the rent for the motel because I couldn't afford even a Skid Row motel. I weighed 85 pounds. I was suffering from malnutrition. I had three children. One of them didn't live with me because I couldn't really take care of the other two either, but they were still with me. Couldn't afford food for the kids. You know, I remember that many nights dinner for the kids would be a can of creamed corn. And that was because my brother had a tab at the local liquor store, and he could get something there for them to eat. I wore dirty clothes out of the dirty clothes because they were cleaner than the clothes I wore. And I really didn't have the strength to go to the laundromat. I didn't have the money either. But I remember when I did get it together, I would throw diapers and Levi's, I mean, one load, diapers, Levi's, everything I could get into one load. And throw it in the laundry and then lay on the laundromat floor because I was so weak, you know, that I couldn't do much else. And so that's, you know, what it all came down to for me. And I remember, and I had been in the hospital many, many, many times. And I had gone to several different kinds of churches. I was looking for the one that God went to because, you know, I'd go to one, they'd say, oh, no, you know, just we're the real church and that all those people are going to hell. And I didn't buy any of that. And I couldn't stay sober. And even when I went to church, it was more like plea bargaining with God. You know, I mean, I'll go to church. I'll do all this. I'll be, you know, whatever I'm supposed to be. And then your end of it is that you need to make me happy. You need to give me all the things in life I want and, you know, and he never kept up his part of the bargain, so I didn't keep up mine either. And in October of 1973, I stood at the turning point. I had watched enough TV, and I saw in a lot of TV programs people made, like movies, they made like pacts with the devil. And I thought, what have I got to lose? You know, I'm already living in hell. What have I got to lose? It can only get better. And so that's what I was considering doing. And where this thought came from me, I don't know. I do know. We all know. But I didn't know at the time, didn't plan on it. But it occurred to me, what happened is I actually said my very first honest prayer to God. And that was, God, I don't care what you do with me. I don't care if you put me in a mental institution for the rest of my life. I don't care if I go to jail. I don't care if you take these kids away from me. I don't care what you do with me. But I can't live like this any longer. And a series of miracles took place. My parole officer came to the house and told me that I had to clean up or I had to do a 30-day dry out. And I knew that I couldn't clean up. I knew that as long as there was alcohol out there on the streets, that there was no way I was going to stay away from it. I could not. And the second miracle that happened is that I was honest with him. I didn't try to scam him. Always in the past, you know, I had a story for him. And this time I didn't have a story for him. I just said, okay, you know, that I would go. And I went back. I was in a institution called California Rehabilitation Center. And so I went back there, and I met a girl that I had done time with in the past, and she had been going to Alcoholics Anonymous on the streets. And she invited me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous inside the institution. And I went for two reasons. I didn't think I was an alcoholic, but I went because I had nothing else to do that night. And they would give you cigarettes to smoke. And so, and I had been smoking Rollies and, you know, so I went. And what happened was unbelievable. I met, this panel of women came into the institution to share. And I knew, somehow I knew they were just like me. It was like I was an alien from another planet, and here were people that were from my planet, you know? And it was like, oh, God, you know, because I didn't know anybody like me. And they smiled. You know, they smiled, and they said, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it. And what they had is they had money in their pocket, and they weren't drunk, and they weren't loaded, and I didn't know how the hell they could do that, you know. I figured they must have something inside that's good, you know, that feels right, you know. That hole inside of them is gone. So that's why I came, that's why I started coming, I thought. And I also knew one other thing. I knew that if I went to one of them and I said, I want to drink, you know, I want to drink, that they wouldn't ask me something silly like, why? My sister-in-law was not an alcoholic, and she always came, you know, she always tell me, Marcia, if you feel like drinking, come to me and we'll talk. And I always wondered what we would talk about. Because she didn't drink. And, you know, and so how, so... So anyway, that's how my journey began in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm very, very fortunate. I think that God chooses for each of us the best conditions under which we can get sober. And for me, that was to go back to jail. And I got out, my parole officer, I had no place to go, so my parole officer picked me up and he took me to this recovery house. Now, 34 years ago, recovery houses were not like they are today. Most people drank and used. And this was a big house. There was about 60 people that lived there. They all drank and they all used drugs. The director used to get loaded at night and then go busting down doors, you know, to catch other people that were getting loaded. The alcoholics were allowed to use drugs, and the drug addicts were allowed to drink. And there was two counselors there that were clean and sober, and you know, they of course were my Eskimos. And I used to, and so when I was going to meetings in the institution, the one thing that I heard them say over and over again was, call Alcoholics Anonymous as soon as you get out. As soon as you can get to a phone, before you do anything else, before you call your family, before you, you know, kiss your kids, before you do anything, call Alcoholics Anonymous. And they would say that at every meeting, and they drill that into my head. And so immediately when I got out, the first thing I wanted to do was call Alcoholics Anonymous. And I made contact with some people that lived in Chino. Now, I lived in Upland, which was about 25 miles from Chino. This guy used to come. This was wintertime. This was November when I got out. And this guy used to come on his motorcycle from Chino to Upland, take me back to a meeting in Chino, drive me back to Upland, and go home to Chino. He drove 100 miles a night on his motorcycle to take me to a meeting. That was being of service, you know. And I thank him today. You know, he's my Eskimo. I love him. I see him occasionally. He's still sober. And, you know, he was the first love affair I had in Alcoholics Anonymous, because the man, I mean, he was married. I didn't have that kind of love affair, but I would have liked to, though. Oh, he was cute. And that was the beginning of sobriety for me, you know. And so I would go to meetings. Where am I at?
Okay.
I would go to meetings, and I would tell my friends in Chino, because I'm here in Upland. I don't have a car. I don't have any money. I don't have a job. Nobody's going to take me on a job interview, because they'd give me a ride to the liquor store if I needed it, but they weren't taking me to a job interview. I wasn't on welfare, you know, so I had nothing, you know, and I used to tell my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, I gotta get a job. I had to get these things, you know, and my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous would say, Marcia, if you concentrate on making sobriety your number one priority, if you just focus on staying sober, if that's your primary purpose, is just to stay sober, somehow, some way, all those other things will come about for you. And so that's what I did. That's all I knew how to do. And I would go to meetings and I'd say, what else did I say? There was something else I said. But the point I'm trying to make is that what they did for me is they placed the responsibility of my sobriety on my shoulders. You know, if I could have had somebody take me under their arm and say, well, I'll take care of you, and somehow they let me down, you know, then this would just have been another pit stop for me, you know. But what they did is they told me that I was responsible for my sobriety, and if I wanted to stay sober, you know, then I couldn't pick up the drink. That was the other thing they said. If you don't pick up a drink, you can't get drunk, you know. And so that's how it all began for me. I was willing to go to any lengths. When I was 3 months sober, I felt like I had reached another turning point, actually, you could say. I was totally overwhelmed. I mean, I was not accustomed to getting up in the mornings and doing things, you know, like paying the rent, buying groceries, you know, things like that. I was just totally overwhelmed. I had two little babies in diapers, and you know, it was just, I was so overwhelmed. I felt like, God, I wish I could just be a little squirrel or something that could bury myself. I could just bury myself under the ground and just kind of just watch everything go by, you know, and not have to, you know, deal with it all. And I realized that I felt like that my reprieve was running out. And I went to my sponsor's house late that night, and we talked. And I made a decision that I was going to place the two babies that were with me in a foster home for a period of time. I felt, you know, I had to talk through all the guilt associated with that, you know, because I knew that, you know, people didn't do that. I knew that, you know, there was a part of me that was going to be glad I was out from under all the pressure, you know, and. But I also knew, and what it finally came down to for me was that that sobriety had to be my number one priority. And I really felt like I wasn't going to be able to hold on much longer. So we made a decision that night that in the morning she would go with me and I would take those babies and we would put them in foster care. And I woke up the next morning, guess what? It was like all lifted. You know, it was all gone. I didn't have to do that, you know. But I was willing to do it, and that's what's important. Because, you know, if I lose my sobriety, I don't have anything. Those kids should have been taken away from me a long time ago, you know. So everything for me is contingent, and it is for you. I know you all feel the same way. It's contingent on your sobriety. You know, everything I have today, everything I am, everything I have is based on, you know, my sobriety. I'm not a person that... I wasn't one of those people either that the things were lifted, the desire to drink was lifted from me. That didn't happen. That didn't happen to me for a long, long time. And I also came to the very same conclusion that every time, you know, and people I sponsor, I tell them the same thing, you know, because a lot of times they'll say, well, you know, I don't feel like I've gone far enough yet, or, you know, I've been having this desire to drink or the craving, you know, or whatever. And to me, that just proves you're an alcoholic. I mean, alcoholics don't have those kinds of feelings and thoughts and cravings. So it just, you know, proves that you're an alcoholic. So, but I want to tell you about something that happened to me. And I was about 2 years sober, and I'm driving down the street one day. I had gotten off work early. I was working. I was driving a new car. I had money in the bank. You know, kids were doing well. Life was good. Looking forward to the weekend, not a cloud in the horizon, right? And it occurred to me, a drink would really be nice right now. And you know, I'd been coming long enough. I knew, you know, I thought it through. You know what happens, Marsh, if you drink, you can lose the kids, you can lose the job, you can lose the car, you can lose everything. You're going to wind up back in Skid Row. You're going to wind up, you know, maybe you won't even have a Skid Row motel. I mean, you know, nothing good can come from you taking a drink. Is it worth it? And the answer came back, yeah, it's worth it. But I didn't drink. I had been coming to Alcoholics Anonymous long enough to know what to do, not to drink, to get through that. But it was definitely a turning point for me. I tell the people I sponsor too, you know, you have a list of things you need to do before you pick up a drink. You call your sponsor. If you can't reach her, you call somebody else. If you can't reach them, you call somebody else. You go to a meeting. You postpone it for 24 hours, you know. But there are this list of things that you do before you pick up a drink, and that's what I did that day. I went through the list of things that I needed to do not to pick up a drink. And I didn't drink that day. And so I'm, you know, I'm very, very grateful that I was able to hear the things that I needed to hear. I know, I mean, I hear all the time, you know, people, and my life is, you know, good today. My kids are raised. I raised my grandson, you know. I'm financially secure. I really don't have any problems in my life today. Why am I saying that? I can't remember why I brought that up. Yeah. So everything. I came here. I had no skills. The only thing I knew how to do was serve drinks in a bar and dance on a table. And today, you know, I've put myself through college. I've raised my children. I had a parole officer once. I took parenting classes from him. I didn't know anything about parenting. I took classes from him. And, I guess it was like 15 years later, he and I were sitting in a business meeting together, and we were equals. You know, we were equals. In fact, I had more experience in the subject than he did, so I was able to help him with it. And you know, everything I have is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I want to tell you this. There have been many, many days, many, many days in my sobriety when the very best I could do is not drink that day. There are many days where I stayed in bed with the covers over my head because I couldn't face the day. I couldn't function. Remember, I called a friend one time and I said, I can't get out of bed. I can't get out of bed. I just can't get out of bed. And she said, she talked to me for a while, and she said, Marcia, she said, okay. She said, this is what we're going to do. Take a shower, and I'm going to come over, and then you and I are going to go do blah, blah, blah. And I hung up the phone, and I said, she didn't understand. I can't get out of bed. But, you know, I stayed sober on that day. And the people that I admire, the people that I admire most in Alcoholics Anonymous are the ones that wake up in the morning and they say, they see absolutely no reason on God's earth to stay sober. And they stay sober anyway. Thank you for letting me share.
Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. I'm sure most of you know the definition of coincidence that bounds around the rooms. There is no such thing as coincidence. A coincidence is a small miracle for which God chooses to remain anonymous. I was sitting at a table 2 days ago at this convention working on some material for a committee I'm on, and two fellows from Cleveland sat down across the table from me. And we struck up a conversation, and somewhere in the course of the conversation, Richard looked at me and said, "What was your turning point?" And I had not told him I was chairing this session. Coincidence? I think not. They told me it's the chairman's prerogative to share a little bit if there's time. So I'm going to tell you my turning point, and I'm going to tell you a second turning point. I'd known for a long time I was an alcoholic. I just wasn't a bad one. I had a job. I had a wife and kids. I had a house. I made money. I had been successful in a career. I was a little less so. When we moved to Louisville. I moved to Louisville because I interviewed on a day in the middle of Kentucky Derby week. I interviewed in the lobby bar of a downtown hotel, and it was surrounded with drunks, and I thought, I gotta live in this town. For 2 years, I lived and worked there and drank, and I did some volunteer work on Saturday mornings at foot races, putting up finish lines, water stops, things like that, and Special Olympics got paid $10 if I showed up, so I did. But it was Saturday morning at 6 o'clock. You know what I looked like at Saturday morning at 6 o'clock? Something the cat drug in. There were two fellows working that finish line who were members of this fellowship. One, as a matter of fact, was the police officer in charge of the employee assistance for the county police department. And they would watch me show up every Saturday morning looking awful, and they'd ask me what I did the night before. They wanted to hear, you know, they wanted to, oh, yeah, you did that. I used to do that. I said, what do you mean you used to do that? Oh, we'll talk about it later. One morning, Buzz asked me, he said, you ever drink in the morning? I said, oh, no, only bad drunks drink in the morning. 2 weeks later, I showed up and I said, Buzz, you know what I found out? I put a little vodka in my orange juice this morning. It took that edge off. And he turned to Danny and he said, he's close. I said, what are you talking about? They said, we'll tell you later. The company I work for threw a big party at a downtown hotel, previewing our fall offerings. And I went down to have a glass of wine. You know the glass of wine? Party ended at 10:30, went to the saloon I regularly drank at, drank there until 2 o'clock in the morning. The owner made an offer to me no saloon keeper had ever made before. He offered to have a bartender drive me home. I declined. I said I was all right. I wasn't going home. They had a 2 o'clock license, but there was a place between them and my house that had a 4 o'clock license. So I went out and drank till 4 o'clock. Got me a go cup at closing time. Got out in the car. Drove home in a blackout. And wrecked my car in my driveway. Got hung up on a brick wall over a drainage ditch, and it was awful. I went in and went to bed. Here is my turning point. I got up the next morning when my wife and kids got up, I never missed a day of work. By God, I was going to make it to work. I was going to have the car towed and figure out how to get there, but I was not going to miss work. I got up, and I looked out the second floor window. And my wife couldn't get out of the driveway to take the kids to school. She had three little boys in the back seat, and she had to drive across the neighbor's lawn. And I stood there with tears in my eyes, because look what I had done. Look how I had humiliated the people I loved, the people closest to me, the people I wanted the most for. I picked up the phone. I called Danny. And I said, I think I'm ready to take a look at that club you belong to. Danny took me to my first meeting that night. He took me to work, brought me home, picked me up, took me to a meeting, gave me a big book, and I read it cover to cover that night. And I'm standing before you 10,536 days later, and who'd have thought I'd be here at an international conference? That's one turning point. Second one was, I started smelling better, talking better, not thinking better. But you know, when you had one of those meetings where you wanted to talk about the third step, that was a good time for me to take a nap or to make some notes for what I had to do the next day or something like that. Because God and I had not been conversant for a long time. I was on the road. I was right up the road here in Austin, Texas. I was 8 years sober. I'd been a GSR, DCM, sponsored people. You know, I really looked like the real deal in AA. Had no spiritual program. None. Zero. Zip. I went to this convention in Austin. Saturday night, they were having a banquet and a big cash bar, and I didn't need to be there. So I called the central office and I asked them if there was a meeting near my hotel. Well, the closest one was down south of the river in a clubhouse. I had a rental car. I drove down there and pulled up out in front, and this clubhouse looked like something the Hell's Angels had abandoned. I mean, I've seen some ugly-looking buildings, but Texas has got some ugly-looking buildings. It was clapboard, white clapboard, and there were gaps in the clapboard. It was raining, and the wind was blowing, and it's coming in through the cracks in the clapboard. But I got inside, and there was a coffee pot, and you were there. And that's all I needed on that Saturday night. And I sat down, and a young woman who was the daughter of one of the big oil families up in Midland, Odessa, began to tell her story. She was going to law school at the University of Texas. She had a Texas state legislator with her that night, who was a member of the program, and he was working on getting her arrest record, her conviction record, absolved so that she could stand for the Texas bar. And she told her story. She told about being taken to the hospital twice. Second time she did die, and they brought her back. She talked about losing her kids. She talked about selling one of her kids for drug money. She had one hell of a story. And she had no God in her life. And she said every morning, she got up and she read from the start of the promises to the end of that chapter. And after time, she began to feel God in her life. I went back to the hotel and I said, oh, what the hell? I'll try it. I tried it for 3 years. There is God in my life today. That's two turning points. I'm waiting for the next one. We'll entertain remarks, questions, whatever from you. If you've got them, there's a microphone in the center of the aisle. Please go to the microphone.
Is it all right just to share a minute? Is that okay?
Sure.
My turning point is in sobriety. My name is Diana C. from Santa Monica, and I am a very grateful alcoholic this moment. Thank you for being here. May 5th, Cinco de Mayo, I turned 3. And May 25th, I also turned 44. And on May 25th, I'd handed my mother and my aunt keys to my home and my office and my storage with names and numbers and addresses. And I said, I'm not doing this alone anymore. I need someone to know where my stuff is. And I was done. I didn't want to drink, but I was ready to die in sobriety. I had 4.5 years and went out for financial and fear reasons. Thank God I had a woman's group that said, you keep coming back. We love you. 7 weeks and a mother who loved me dearly. I got back because of them, my mother in that room. But at 3 years sober, I was ready to let it all go because I was tired of suffering and doing it alone. And I said, I will not go out without giving everything I've got. And I let everybody know that I love them. I was not dramatic. I was very clear. I had a very clear plan. And the moment I surrendered and let them in, everything changed. It took me 7 years in sobriety and one slip to get that. And my mom is 44 years sober. I get to be here with her. This is 3 weeks ago, you guys. This is sobriety for me. It was worse in here than it was my worst day ever out there. And I was left for dead once. I'm so grateful that at 2 years old, my mother was 2 years sober and we found each other. I obviously knew an alcoholic even at two. And I'm so grateful that she introduced me to these rooms so that when I finally surrendered, I was in your arms. And I am so very grateful to be alive today through the grace that is a thread that runs through all of us. And these moments, these days, are so precious because that surrender was complete. I was willing to let go of everything I was fighting so hard to hold on to, the career, the office, the home. I was going to be homeless within 3 days of my birthday. I was going to lose my office, all of my insurance. Everything was going to be done 2 days after my natal birthday, and I had had it. I could not do this life alone anymore. And whatever that pride or ego was, left when I handed over my keys. And I'm very grateful. So if there is anyone in sobriety with 1 day or 500 years, and you're suffering or you're scared, just hand over the keys and surrender whatever it is, please, because I can't explain it. But the hand of the universe and my higher power, which is yours and mine, came in. And I'm so very, 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 very grateful I get to sit with my mom tonight and the old timers and listen to you all and see the light in your eyes and the sparks in your being. And everyone is like glowing to me here. And I just needed it. When I saw the turning point, that was what I had written on the top of that letter. With the keys and the addresses, I said, this is Diana's turning point. I didn't say it's my suicide or I'm going. I was not dramatic. I just said, I'm giving it my all, and then I'm okay if I go. I gave it my all, and my plan changed. I got plans with the S today, and I'm walking with you, and I just needed to share that because I know there's people hurting in sobriety. And just keep coming back. Please just keep coming back. Please just keep coming back. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome back.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Irene. Hi. My sobriety date is September 10th, 1992, and I'm from California. I loved hearing from all of you, and it just struck home to me. One of my most significant turning points was in sobriety. I had already got a sponsor and was through the program about 6 months, and she moved away. I had to get a new sponsor. And my new sponsor insisted I go through the steps again, and I thought, how dare you? So I started going through the steps with her, and I got to the second step, and I knew I couldn't go any further because I'd heard about this higher power and creator everybody talked about, and I knew I didn't believe what you all were talking about was true, that it couldn't happen for me. And I finally told her how I was feeling, and she said to go out and search for your God wherever you need to find it before we go on. And I came across this one book somewhere, and I was doing a lot of searching, and it took passages from the Bible that corresponded to our steps. And I'm not here to preach anything. I'm just saying this is where I found this for me. And what I found the story of this man in there whose father or his son had died, and he heard about Jesus and the miracles, but he didn't believe. So he took his son, he went to Jesus, and he said, please bring my son back to life. And Jesus tells him, first you must believe. And he realized that he didn't believe, but he wanted to believe. So his prayer became, I believe, help me with my unbelief. And when I read that, I realized that was me. I wanted so badly to believe what you guys were saying was true. And I had a bigger, huge part of me that was just in doubt, that it was all a bunch of BS. So I started to say that prayer on a daily basis, or whenever I could think about it. And one day this guy knocked on my where I work, and he worked in town, and he said, I hear you're a friend of Bill W's. And so he came in and we started talking, and he started telling me, I love AA, I love the people in there and the social stuff, but if they just get that God stuff out of there, he goes, it would be great. And he was going on, and I remember my jaw was dropping, and suddenly I started going, what are you talking about? How can you take God out of AA? If God's not in AA, who's going to restore you to sanity and make you sober and blah, blah, blah? And it was hilarious because all of a sudden I went, oh, I heard myself. And I realized that somewhere inside of me, I believed just enough that it could possibly happen for me. And what that did, that was my turning point. It doesn't mean at that moment I believed everything I heard in here, but it opened the door enough, just enough, for me to accept and explore the rest of it. And that moment has never left me. And when I have any doubt about anything in sobriety or life today, that prayer still holds me true. You know, I always get to a new point and I go, well, God won't carry me through this. And God always does. So anyway, thank you.
We've got 10 minutes left, and what do we got? Two people in line, so we ought to be okay.
All right. Hi, everybody. My name's Dennis. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is February 4th, 1996. And not only was it my sobriety day, it was also a spiritual awakening. And the turning point for me on that day was that I can't do this alone. Up until that day, I've been around AA since 83, and I came back to AA in 94 it wasn't my worst bottom. I've had worse bottoms. But I had no other place to go, so I started going to meetings. But I was doing it all by myself. And up until that day, that weekend, I decided that, okay, this was going to be the first weekend I wasn't going to drink. And I went hiking, and still trying to do this all by myself. And the turning point was, you know, if I keep coming to these meetings, I'm going to hear something that's going to help me. And I can hear it a million times, and it won't help me. But the millionth and one time, a little light bulb will go off. And my spiritual awakening that day was something that I heard often and often in these meetings, but it just parted my hair. I couldn't understand it. And what came to me that day was, if I don't drink, I won't get drunk. Thank you.
My name is CJ, and I'm an alcoholic. I was born in Texas, but I got sober out there in California 40 years later. One of the biggest turning points, I guess, in my life was after 6 days in Fresno County Jail, I was walking into a place for recovery, and I thought, oh, my God, my life has come to this. You know, never mind 6 days prior to that, I was picking ashtrays out of the cigarette butt in front of the courthouse in Fresno, California. That didn't bother me, but walking into recovery, saying, oh, my God, you know. But I did what I was told. Y'all told me to read that book. Y'all told me to get sponsorship. Y'all told me to work the steps. And I did what I was told because I was afraid I was going to go to prison if I didn't. That's how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. We were one of those pieces of paper. I stayed Alcoholics Anonymous today, a little over 18 years later, because I just don't want to get drunk anymore. And I know this thing works. My biggest turning point in my life, I think, as far as Alcoholics Anonymous was, I was 3 or 4 months sober, and out there in California, I was a garbage man. And 3 or 4 months, I was at the end of my route, and I looked across the street, and there was that liquor store that I always used to get my 40 to go to the dump with. And I knew in my deepest bowels that I was going to drink that day. I just knew it. But I didn't know what else to do. I remember what you people told me. You said, when you know you're going to drink, if you'll ask God, you won't have to drink. I got down on my knees in that street by that loud, nasty, stinking garbage truck and said, God help me. And as quick as that thing came to me, it was gone. I got in that truck that day, went to the dump, and I haven't had anything like that again. I've had some kind of close ones, like maybe a drink would be good today. And I thought, well, how stupid would that be? You know, why do you, like you said, a couple of you speakers said, all the things I've got, you know, I wouldn't just be putting a couple of $5 bills or something up there to get me a six pack. I'd be like a friend of mine back there in that corner says, I'd be putting up my house, my car, the love of my kids, my grandkids. Just put it all up on a bar because that's what it's going to take. Because when I'm one of those people, when I start drinking, I don't stop drinking. The only way they stopped me the last time was to throw me in jail for 6 days, and they didn't serve Budweiser for breakfast, is what my custom was. So that was, but when I got down on my knees that day, that's the one I have to remember. If that urge ever comes again, it works. And I only learned that in here. I didn't learn that in jail. I didn't learn that at the 7-Eleven waiting on a phone call. Some of y'all know what that means. But I learned it in here. So if I want to keep sober, I better keep coming back because there might be a few more things I need to know. Although I'm all knowing and all caring, there might be a few more things that you people can teach me. So I'll just keep coming back until hopefully the day I die and I have to go meet my maker. And if I don't do anything else right, I can at least stand in front of him and say, at least I did the best I could while I was there. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to thank our speakers again, and maybe we could show them some more appreciation. And if we would, let's close it up with the Serenity Prayer.